everyone, and welcome to a special episode of NWR Connectivity. I'm your host, John Reardon, and I am joined today by Willem Hilhorst.
Hello there.
We were talking before the show. You've never been on one of our podcasts before, and we've never spoken outside of Slack, apparently.
Yeah, that was kind of confronting, actually. Who could have guessed that time zones impact this conversation and this work relationship that we have?
Right. Yeah, it is a 7-hour time difference for us.
Yeah, currently it's almost 10, so I don't know. 10
and it's almost 3 p.m. for me. So that's, I did my math right. Got the time zone right.
I can tell you 7 hours from now, the world still exists. So, that's how it works.
It's like a little, You have any thing I should bet on or anything?
We have that Direct coming up, and of course,
have you seen that yet?
Yeah, it's great. It has everything you ever wanted, right?
Yeah,
that's how it goes. but it's awesome to be here finally. Like we had to put it together for a little bit, but honestly, I finally have the excuse to be on here, and I really love chatting about this stuff. So yeah, thank you for having me.
Of course, we're here to talk about Gamescom 2024. But first, Willem, because you haven't been on any of our podcast coverage before, it's possible that people might not know you. And because like your actual day job even factors into some of the stuff with video games as well, I just wanted to give you a second to sort of introduce yourself.
Yeah, thank you so much. So my name is Willem Hilhorst. I live in the Netherlands, so I'm a Dutchie. I am almost 28, actually, next month, so that's coming up soon. I've been writing about games for, on and off for about 10 years now. It's been really weird because I've always enjoyed video creation and online content in general. So games fit very naturally into that. And ever since 2021, I started working at what we call the Netherlands Institute for Sound and Vision, which is our Netherlands audiovisual archive. So we preserve all broadcast media in the Netherlands, that's radio and television. And ever since 2017, they've also been preserving video games from the Netherlands. So that's my job. I actually work with Dutch developers and rights holders to make sure that their games are preserved for eternity in a playable state in our archive. And we primarily use emulation as a tool because we think that's the most the best way to preserve digital games, because they're digitally originally, so you want to preserve them digitally. So I don't get to play games all day, but I do get to work very closely with Dutch developers and just talking about games for my job, which is a lot of fun.
So is that like government funded or is that like privately funded?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So we are primarily government funded because it's our task by law to do that preservation of broadcast media. But we do have a little bit of additional funding that doesn't go into that day-to-day operation. So that about 70% of our budget goes towards the preservation of Dutch media. And within that budget, we have some flexibility to also preserve, as we call them, digital-born media. So I also do websites, web video, and podcast archival. And games are part of that as well. So we really want to broaden that scope of what media is, because it isn't just television and radio anymore like it was 30 years ago.
Right.
So we're trying to actively pursue that as well.
That's awesome. And I wish more countries did that. mine would be nice.
It is so weird when I talk to other countries. Every country has their own rules, regulations, and laws about this stuff. And the Netherlands is also fairly badly regulated in that stuff. Like, we have to be the active party that goes out for the preservation of this sort of thing. It's not that they're required by law to preserve with us, but we do have like the capability and a means to preserve these works. So we have an infrastructure underground underneath our building that currently has the capability for 36 petabyte of data. And whenever something is broadcast on national radio and television in the Netherlands, 7 minutes later, it's into our archive all automatically. So all the other stuff we do outside of that, that is actually like going out to people, talking with rights holders and making sure that their work is preserved. And then it can be reused or re-examined. And what I really like is that with the games, we originally started focusing only on the games themselves, but nowadays, kind of since I started, I want to say, we've also been expanding our reach to include design document, concept arts, behind the scenes materials. And that's been really cool. I think 4 months ago, we got the full working archive for Two Tribes, who originally developed Tokitori and Rive and a lot of games that you might have played on the DS and Wii era. They published
8 games in their existence, which is quite a few. We got 24 projects, a lot of them canceled, wow. a lot of them original designs and pitches that they throw out but weren't viable enough to create full games out of. So we're still going through those materials and seeing what's relevant, what we can use, and how we can make that the best preserved for future researchers and users.
That is fantastic. Yeah. I could probably spend the podcast just talking about that, but I'm going to pivot.
Very good. Very good. Otherwise, I'd be here all night.
To Gamescom.
Yeah.
Now, Gamescom. So maybe this is my American perception. Obviously, I've been aware of Gamescom for a while, but I feel like here, we had up until recently E3, and that was sort of our big gaming convention thing. That was when everything got announced, when everything happened. And we paid attention to Gamescom, but it was definitely kind of like secondary. I feel like now that E3's dead, may it never be revived.
Right.
I feel like Gamescom has sort of come into the spotlight a bit more over here. So why don't you give me a rundown of Gamescom for me, anybody over here who's less familiar with it as a convention.
Right. Yeah. So Gamescom's been existing for, I believe, about 20 years, actually. Well, I think, no, it's been about 15, 20 years. I don't know exactly. I've been going for about 7 years now, and it is the largest video game convention conference in the world. Like, it is understated how big this event is. It is not just one hall or two halls. No, it's 7 halls in the Köln Messe in Cologne, or Köln, as we have to say in Germany. And Köln is a fairly big city in Germany. It's on the west side of the country, so it's fairly close to the Netherlands. So actually, I can just drive 2 hours and I'm in Cologne and I can just go to the convention. It's really cool.
Nice.
But yeah, in size-wise, it is enormous. And that is because of actually two reasons. One reason is because all the publishers go there from the continental Europe, but also abroad. They've really realized that this is the big event to showcase their games to the European audience. It is also fairly easily located and accessible for people in Asia and Africa as well. So we've seen a lot more developers and especially people just going to Gamescom to kind of present their works there as well. Gamescom has also been expanding. They now have a conference in Asia and Latin America as well. So I think they've been really embracing the fact that their brand name is getting more recognized.
Sure.
But for us, it has always been our E3, right? That is the easy comparison. I think the big difference is that unlike E3, there's not that, I want to call it, very lovingly American showmanship to the whole thing.
Sure. Oh, go for it. Go for it.
Jeff Keighley has appropriated Opening Night Live as his little bit of Americana in Gamescom.
I would like to apologize on behalf of North America that Jeff Keighley made it over there.
He's Canadian. Like, I think you guys are safe.
It's fine. Technically still North America, so I can still apologize, but
you're allowed.
We tried to keep him from crossing the ocean, but he found a boat somewhere.
Look, he has this very designated spot on the podium, and that's where he gets to sit, and most of the fun stuff he can over to his European co-host, because otherwise we also would not listen to him. And sometimes he somehow captures Hideo Kojima in a bottle and he lets him out on stage, so
I don't,
we'll allow
Kojima
it.
Blink twice if you need help.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's fun, actually, that Keighley has kind of been the one to push Gamescom to the international US audience, in particular with his Opening Night Live. While the show itself, like, if you watch the opening, I don't, like, we in Europe, I think, barely watch it because there's plenty to do outside of just watching Opening Live. And it really feels like, okay, Lee wants to do it in E3, but in Europe, and it doesn't work that way. And the games are not accommodating for that as well. Like, I can say very broadly, Europeans have quite a bit of different taste in games.
Right.
So if you were to debut a farming simulator on the European stage, that will go over nuts. I think in the US, that's
probably not as much.
Right. So Gamescom has been really growing into its own and become more and more visible as like the premier game conference. And like for journalists, it has always been the one place you have to go to meet everyone. Like everyone goes there. And it used to be like European journalists were to go to E3 in June and then go to Gamescom in August. And that is kind of like you see a lot of overlap between those two programmings, right? A lot of the games and demos shown there are also in Europe. But you have more easier access to developers because, you know, you're in Europe, you kind of have already a sort of closer connection inherently to the convention. But now with E3 gone, like that has shifted tremendously. So
where, especially over the last 2 years, we've seen a lot more international publishers actually making the trek to Europe for Gamescom. And from what I've gathered from everyone that I talk to, they are really into it. It's quite funny. I had interviews with both Wade Rosen, the CEO of Atari, as well as Chris Kohler from Digital Eclipse and the guys from Limited Run Games. And they were all from the US. And they were like, yeah, this is my first or second time here in Cologne. And I really like it. And it also, it has been the last time we were at an event like this was 2019, because E3 was then for the last time.
Right.
So that, seeing that feeling again and Cologne being able to recreate that vibe, but on a much larger scale, I think goes over really well internationally. So even if you do not keep track of Gamescom the way you did E3, right? Nintendo will not do their public unveilings. Xbox will not, you know, show their new console at Gamescom. I think that will never happen because, you know, those publishers are so well guarded of their own things. But to get hands-on and personal time with the developers and publishers in particular, it is the best place to go to. Because even if you do not run into them at the convention hall, you probably find them in one of the many bars in the city center of Cologne, and it's just a blast to chat with them and have a drink. And yeah, it just, you know, the Germans know how to host a party, and that's
well, and I mean, even, you know, like Xbox, I don't think revealed any games or anything, but like we did get the release date for Indiana Jones while we were there.
They are super present. Like, to give you an example, right? I say seven halls, right? So there's three halls dedicated to like the consumer, right? Those are the big booths that you might have seen at E3 as well, with big lines for playing demos of games. Then there's also the, I call them general audiences booth, but there's the indie mega arena, which contains all the indie parties that want to showcase their game. And it's very big, but there's all these little stations right next to each other. I think PAX might be comparable to that. Sure. It's a little bit tighter because they have a separate area. Then they're in that same hall, there's also the retro area booth, where a lot of like video game, well, preservation collectives, but also fans, collectors, people that just have a setup with like 12 CRTs to play Daytona with 12 players. They set it up there to play. They have the full Rock Band setup where everyone can just play and hang out. It is a lot of interactive fun with audience members. There's a job market there too, where you can apply for jobs within the games industry or show what the games industry can offer for working possibilities. And then the other halls, so there's two halls that are dedicated just to buying merch, which is deadly on any day after the business days because the crowds are just insane. It is so packed with people. And again, I was talking about those halls and differences. Wednesday and Thursday tend to be the days for press only, so you only have journalists, influencers, and everyone, so it's very much breathable, excluded. And then starting usually at midday Thursday until Sunday, the general audience can buy admission tickets, and that's like €30, so it's not expensive to go to it. And they can just play all the games in the main areas or go to the merchandise halls, and it becomes so crowded with people. On Friday afternoon, the business area is deserted because everyone's just fleeing Gamescom from the general, and from the people that have meetings, everything. They're like, we're done, we're out of here, and we don't want to be here on Saturday. The one that's really victim are the indies, which are stuck in the indie arena booth in the public halls until Sunday. And those are some troopers, I will tell you that much. Like, they've been there showcasing their game all day long, all week long. It's crazy. So those are the general halls, and then there's four halls dedicated to just business area. And those are divided in publishers, countries. So every country has a delegation that has a separate pavilion that they can show games and other services that their country offers. And then there's also one that's dedicated to like side areas of the games industry. So accessory makers, hardware makers, VR stands, all that sort of thing. They have their own separate areas as well. So if you have appointments like me and you talk to developers beforehand, you make a schedule, you meet up with people, you get all these press emails. And then it's just like, oh, you have to go from hall 4 to hall 2. And you're like, well, they're next to each other. But you have to cross the entire hall, go through a separate segment area, and then go to hall 2 and then find the booth still. Like, it is a lot of running around. If you have back-to-back meetings, It's honestly, you're doing a workout. I think I met someone who was showing me their steps they'd taken during the weekend, and it was like over 30,000 on a single day. It's so hard to explain like how much you're walking and talking around. And you can, if you're a business, you can buy a stand so you get people to come to you, which is genuinely probably much easier. But like, there's so many journalists and press appointments, like everyone's walking through each other. And I think like, as you walk through these halls, you see how big the games industry is in Europe. And I think that's really heartening. You also run into people that you only see once a year at the event, which is very funny. You're like, hey, I see you. You see, say hi for 5 minutes and then you run along and you don't see them until next year, which is, you know, there's a vibe hanging around Gamescom that's just very amicable. And I think that's, you know, I think I've heard similar things about E3. You can probably better speak to that than me or PAX even. I think PAX has
PAX is better.
More.
PAX, right, PAX that's is what a I good heard. Time. E3, yeah. Honestly, it sounds like a E3, I would say, seems similar. But the problem with E3 is that you're in one hall. And especially once they open it up to the public, it's like E3 used to be purely for business. Like you couldn't buy a ticket to it.
Yeah.
And then they opened it up to the public and it became a nightmare. Because it's just one
Gamescom.
Hall. There's not enough room for everybody. Like,
right, and Gamescom has always been a public event, so we are very used to the fact that there's all these cosplayers, all these people that are just standing 8 hours in line to play Monster Hunter Wilds, which is, I'm not exaggerating, those lines are genuinely insane.
Yeah.
But like, that's the vibe of Gamescom, and you know what to expect.
And like, it's set up for it.
Yeah,
as opposed
exactly.
to E3, which was definitely not. Like, there was really no plan in place. It was just like, oh, no.
Yeah, I think that kind of explains why E3 had the death it deserved, right?
Yes. Yeah, there are no tears shed for E3.
Yeah, they tried to fly too close to the sun, getting general audiences in, and it just didn't work.
Did not work.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, I was at Gamescom from like Tuesday evening until Friday afternoon, Saturday afternoon. And most of my time was filled with meetings, either for NWR or for my own personal work. But there's a lot of overlap in that. And that's also, if you communicate it properly to developers, they're usually like, oh, that's so cool that you do this as well. And like, yeah, welcome to my life.
Well, and I did enjoy, I'm not exactly sure when this episode is going up, but some of it will be up on our YouTube by then. I enjoyed in a lot of the interviews. I haven't watched all of the interviews you've done so far, because there's a lot. But I enjoy how many of them do like touch on game preservation. Like whether you like you might be talking to like Digital Eclipse about a game they're making, but then you're also going to talk about game preservation and stuff like that, which I was just it's a great topic. And so I enjoy whenever hearing people's views on that and kind of diving off into that tangent.
Yeah, I think especially here, like you get these half an hour appointments and usually you're 10 minutes, either 5 minutes late because of the walking or you're 10 minutes late because someone else is still in there for the meeting. So you don't have a lot of time to actually talk very practically. So that's actually my approach for these interviews, like really talking to these developers and going in with a specific mindset or subject, because I made these appointments pre-booked, right? You can't just walk up to a booth and say, hello, sir, let me please play Monster Hunter. You really have to make the appointments, otherwise you won't get in. So for me, I was very much selective, like, okay, this one has overlap with my work, but also NWR. But also, these are people that know their stuff, right? Or at least I hope they know their stuff. Mm-hmm. So I really want to ask them, like, what is your approach? How do you feel about this? And what do you want to bring to this medium? Because, you know, this is more to my preservation work, but we're in 10 years, we're probably finally getting the first retirees from the games industry, people that are actually have worked our entire life in games and going with retirement. And that is going to be a very big shift in how we see preservation, because those are will be the people that will speak up and say, where's my work? So kind of like being a little bit earlier with that and asking these developers like how they view their role within this, I think it's very valuable, because that's what we're going to be looking at. Like, sure, we're going to be talking about certain games we're going to be talking about Mighty Morphin Power Rangers Rita's Rewind in like 10 years, probably. But I'd rather know, like, how do they view their own role in that?
Yeah, well, I think that talking about that stuff in advance, if a developer doesn't have that stuff in mind, can put them on track to like, are you saving all the random documentation for this? Like, is that stuff being preserved now, or is it getting chucked at the end of development? Like, so having that in mind when you're making the game is a good thing to just sort of get out there to developers if they're not already thinking about it.
Right. And I especially like asking it to people that aren't from like my own country, right? So to learn how other perspectives are about that. Like, I know in the US, right, there's no regulation on that front, or it's either at a state level, if at all. I
could be wrong. It's US is a big place, but I have never heard of a government funded video game preservation organization in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. So I'd rather give them my ideas on the subject and
Please right. tell me if I'm wrong, because I'd love to know. But if you're not doing it yourself, like, okay, well,
right.
take these ideas and see what you can do with them. So that's,
yeah,
it's fun. And Gamescom allows for that. Like, you have these little meeting booths that are hidden away, and you just have a better way of just sitting down with someone. And also, when you're sitting down, like, everyone's running around all day. So if you sit down, you're also like, I'm going to sit down as long as yeah. I can.
Yeah, you're going to take all of that time.
Exactly.
Just, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the stuff that you played.
Right. Yeah.
So let's the one I'm going to throw one at you, because it's one that I'm interested in, which is Nightling.
Yeah.
From the folks behind Pine, the game I wanted to love and I'm going to try to love again.
Yeah, good approach. So the Nightling is developed by Twirlbound. Twirlbound is a studio based in the Netherlands. So full disclaimer, we are working with Twirlbound to preserve Twine at the moment. So I will never review their games, but I will talk to them for this sort of thing I'm previewing. Sure. And the Nightling is really, really fun. So if you haven't seen the trailer, you play as this knightling who is kind of a servant or a squire to a big knight who lives in a world where a giant cataclysm has taken place many decades ago, and everyone's wearing these masks to prove they survived the decade, the calamity. But your knight goes missing, and you take over their place, and your only weapon in the game is a giant shield. So much like Captain America, you can either throw it around or use it to block attacks or swipe back at enemies. But the shield is also a traversal tool. So how they showed this off really well in the trailer is that this world is really designed around slopes and hills. So whenever you are in the air, you can do the shield jump, like much in Zelda, right? Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom. You can just jump down, hop on your shield, and slide down these hills. And you have a little bit of control over them, so you can make those hard turns, and you can slide around, and it feels really good to play. Like, the movement has this sort of flow to it that kind of makes, I don't know, it's like a mashup of Zelda and Mario in a kind of way, where you have this platforming capability where you're jumping around on like bouncing objects, but also sliding around on your shield, and then also fighting with combat and exploration. Like, Twirlbound is really ambitious in this sense, right? They with Pine as well, like, you've played the game at least a little bit, and I think you can feel
I reviewed it. I played it a lot.
Right. I think you can feel that they really want to make these Zelda like games, but on a
Pine
different scale.
Pine is incredibly ambitious. The reason like that's one where when I say I want to like Pine, it is because I love everything Pine was trying to do. I think it was a bit too big for their own ability at the time. But I love the ideas behind Pine, and that's why I'm excited for. I'm like, I'm glad that they're making another thing, because clearly I like where their head's at.
And I want to
like their stuff.
Yeah, and I actively asked them about this, because Pine was very ambitious for them, and they're a studio of about 13 to 15 people, so it's very small. And I asked them, like, Pine was very rough, like, also not on Switch, but other platforms as well. Like, what lessons did you take? And they were very honest and open, saying, like, well, Switch was very troublesome development for us, and we really wanted that to be good, but we had to redo it all because it just didn't fit our ambition. And also with the game, there was just things that we had to scratch in the end because it was too ambitious. And with the Nightling, they partnered with Saber Interactive, who've done a lot of amazing Switch ports. So that is really... that is kind of showing their dedication to wanting this to work on Switch and other platforms that they're releasing on. But also their scope seems to be much more manageable. Like, the game is open world in the sense that you have these large areas to explore with both dungeons and quests and like the sort of general action adventure flair that you might expect.
Yeah.
But it seems much more focused, much more precise. Like, these are the core ideas. It's all revolving around that shield. The shield is used to to hit targets from afar, to open gates, but also if you combine it in combat, you can do some additional moves, and you can upgrade the shield over time. So everything comes back to that central game mechanic, and I think that really helps to hone it in and, like, not to overstay their own welcome, but also to freshen up gameplay over time. Like, they talked about how they wanted the shield when they first had the design, it was very very heavy in its approach, but they wanted to give it a sort of mystical, magical properties to give it a more better flow in combat. So you can, I don't know, they didn't talk about this, but I can see how you can implement like certain elemental attacks into your shield, or even use it as a different in a different way that we aren't even thinking of. Like at one point you can upgrade it to have a glide as well, right? Mm-hmm. I think that by having that particular focus, it just knows how to get at its core idea and identity for what this game is supposed to be. And it's looking really good. I played the PC version. I had about 15 minutes with it, but it was just free to roam around, talk, do a little bit of questing. But they are saying the Switch version is also really shaping up to be nicely. They're aiming for 2025. Of course, I had to ask about Switch 2 because, you know, these are folks that are very enthusiastic. And what they said was like, well, we are aiming to make the Switch version as the best it can possibly be. So if we're presuming that Switch 2 will improve upon that foundation, that should be just perfect, because the Switch is as low as you can get, and let's say PC is right. as high as you can get. Switch 2 can only between those two or even better. So then the groundwork is done.
One would hope that the Switch 2 will be more powerful than the Switch 1. If not, we're in trouble.
Yeah, exactly, right? I think as a sort of fun tie-in, like what I found interesting, like of course you talk to developers about Switch 2. This is more general Gamescom, right?
Yeah.
And I think my biggest takeaway was no one is talking. Like every mm-hmm. developer that I talk to and talk to about this subject is very much like, yeah, we're not announcing for Switch yet, and they mean Switch 1. And when you start pressing them a little bit, it's like, well, you know what's coming next. We would really like to know what's coming next, because if you don't want to throw away your 150 million install base, but also announcing for Switch now at the moment feels like a sort of risk. So a lot of people are hesitant, and like even close sources to mine, even if they know about Switch 2, no one is talking, which is honestly kind of impressive at this point. Like I was genuinely expecting this year to hear something, to tell something. I know friends of mine that talk to accessory makers, and they were like, yeah, motion controls now have to be implemented into the controllers. That's a requirement that Nintendo is setting. But I'm like, that's not really substantial enough to say, well, that Switch 2 is going to do something with that. Yeah. Just be Nintendo being Nintendo. It's weird. Even coming out of this Gamescom, usually you kind of get a feel for it. Yeah. But like no Nintendo was present at the booth. No Nintendo representatives were able to talk to. We know that last year it was actually shown at Gamescom behind closed doors. But yeah, no one is still talking, even if they know about it. It's crazy.
Yeah, I feel like it would. I mean, I'm sure there are, you know, obviously there are developers who have seen it. But for a lot of the indies, I feel like it would be really nice if Nintendo would say whether or not this thing is backwards compatible. Because if I'm making a game, like, it's, you know, obviously if Switch 2 is going to be its own like bespoke thing, then you don't want to release a Switch game and have it immediately on a dead system. But if Nintendo can come out and say, yeah, this thing is backwards compatible, it'll run the Switch games better, like a PS5 or a Series X does with that last gen, then I think it would maybe open up those developers to be like, okay, it's safe to go with Switch. We can start developing for that, and then, you know, we can add on Switch 2 or whatever later. But as is, yeah, I can see where you would be terrified to put all that effort into downporting from PS5 to Switch, only to have something better coming out in March.
Yeah, absolutely. And that kind of reflects on the other games I played at Gamescom, right? There was a very few that were really for Switch that hadn't released earlier elsewhere, right? So you don't really get an advantage of that. A lot of indie games actually were already out. So I talked to the guys who made Skim, which was really fun to see them at the booth as well. But that released like last month. So
yeah,
not really that much going on. So I was really focusing on games that I really was excited about or wanted to play. What I have to bring up in that regard is actually Cairn, I think I'm saying it right, which is the new game from the Game Bakers, who did Fury and then Haven after that. And if you haven't seen the trailer for this, like this is what they call a survival climber. So you are really dedicated to this climbing mechanic where you have to move every single limb while scaling these giant walls and eventually one big mountain called Mount Kara, I think it's called. At first, when I played the game, I was very much like, oh no, this is a 3D version of Quop, if you ever played that.
It feels
super unnatural to control every individual limb and then start making your way up the mountain, because you do use the triggers, but also the way you have tilted your joystick decides which limb you're moving forward. And that is such a weird mechanic to get your head around. It is very accurate to, like, friends of mine are doing bouldering and they know how to climb a bit, and I was like, oh, this seems familiar to what they do. But
the thing is, like, you start with a little training area where you climb a few walls, and the game looks really gorgeous. Like, it has this beautiful art style that is, looks almost, this very shell-shaded, but very painterly as well. And you start doing those first training walls, and you fall off, like, twice, and I was like, okay, well, that's rough, and it's either me or it's just the game not tutorializing very well. But once you get through those first walls, it starts to click, right? And you start to actually feel in touch with your character playing on screen. What I really liked was actually that her stamina meter, whenever it runs out, your controller starts vibrating, and where you actually have to push the button to make sure that she takes a break to regain her strength. Mm-hmm. Because there's too much tension on those individual limbs. So you make a specific stretch where your arm is like stretched out and your leg isn't, and you feel the rumble shaking on one side, and you're like, oh wait, that's too far. I need to climb up there as well. Like, it feels supernatural once you get the hang of it, and it's, yeah, just very impressive to play. I really like climbing games in general, so this clicks for me on multiple levels.
Yeah, it reminds me of what was it called? Toussaint? Did you play that one?
Yeah. Well,
it
the interesting thing is
a bit, like, of that, but you have control of the legs too in this, right? Not just the
exactly.
arms.
Exactly. And Toussaint has a lot of safety guards, right? Where you, if you drop mm-hmm. down, you don't lose all your progress. Here you actually only have six of those. I think they're called pitons, where you put spikes into the wall. Yeah. You only have six of them, and they only recover if you do a little quick time event and you hit it perfectly right. You can reuse them. But also, if you lose all six of them, you can't regain them or regret them. You actually have to craft them by using some survival elements that are in between the big stretches of mountain that you're climbing. So it really plays into that feeling like it's just you versus the mountain into your tent. I asked the developers about it because one of them was there, and they said, yeah, where Haven was very narrative focused, this one we really want to return to game mechanics at its core. Which is totally cool. Like, I think it's that balance of surviving and climbing is something rarely done in games. Usually in games it's like, oh, you get better at the climbing because, you know, get an upgrade, or you get better at, you know, feeling your way out. And this feels very much like, no, you have to struggle every time, and it is that challenge that the game is narratively and mechanically building on.
Mm-hmm. You had one noted down that you wanted to talk out about, Neon Blood.
So Neon Blood is from a group of Spanish developers. They are as indie as you can get. They basically did this as a high school or a student project, and they kind of upgraded it to a full release. Neon Blood is a narrative detective game, which is set in a very much a Blade Runner, cyberpunk-esque world. But what is immediately striking if you look at any footage of it is the combination of pixel art and PS1 3D design. The connection is the other game that's coming out. It's called Replaced, which has a sort of similar vibe, but this one really does its own thing. It is very linear. It is very much a detective game. So you go out, find clues, walk back and forth, and engage with the narrative in the world. And I found that to be really interesting, but also during a game demo of a narrative game, it's very hard to focus on that when people walking around you.
Yeah.
But that visual style, and especially the audio design as well, I was really impressed by. It looks fantastic in motion. They are aiming for a full 60 FPS on Switch as well. I played a PC version, but they are really dedicated to getting the Switch version as good as it can be as well. It looks really promising. So if you're into that, like, detective game, like narrative adventure, Night in the Woods type, like, you know, where you really go around, explore this world, get familiar with these characters, Neon Blood looks really cool. And again, that those graphics in motion, like, it's very hard to convey it in writing or talking, like, what that means, but just seeing those pixel arts interact with 3D models. And I asked actually the developer, like, how did you decide which ones would be pixel art and which one would be 3D models? And they said, mm-hmm. well, that blending is super important to them, because there was this very enormous character sitting on a 3D chair. And I was like, well, that's where the blending kind of clashes, but it doesn't, because the texturing is still very much in those pixel style. And they really worked hard on making that all fit together really well. So it's one to look out for sure.
It's got a bit more interesting of a dynamic to it, or I guess just a more dynamic visual style than like one of the HD 2D games, like a similar setup, right? Of you've got your 2D characters in your 3D world, but there's a bit more like this random thing will also be 2D, or this random thing will be 3D, like a bit more visual variety than the Square Enix stuff has had.
Yeah, and their scope is fairly small. Like I said, it's a narrative game. It's like 6 hours. We really want to make sure that people are just getting involved in this world. And there's some combat in there as well, which kind of uses a sort of, they say a dice system where you roll specific dice against one another. It's very straightforward. It wasn't really the best part of that demo, but it really helps to highlight those visuals again. So like, if you like that sort of thing and want to really see what this world and narrative is about, definitely want to keep an eye out for it.
Awesome. Yeah, that one looks really cool.
Yeah. Speaking of awesome visuals, I didn't get to play too much of it, but it's called Usual June. This is the new game developed and published by Finji, who did Tunic, as well as Chicory, A Colorful Tale, and I Was a Teenage Exocolonist. This game is not scheduled yet for Switch, and they were very hesitant because apparently Finji is like a super small team. I thought they were like a big publisher or whatever, but they're like 5 people, which is very... I was very impressed by that. And this is one of the games they make themselves. So usually they help co-development or co-publishing. But this one is really all their own. It's a narrative-driven game. It has a very gorgeous visual style that is really the reminiscent of like Spider-Verse. It's animated other frame.
It's got the decimated animation and
As well as the shaders look really good as well.
Yep.
It is, the narrative was really heavy to get into because it's a lot about death, and the main character can speak to ghosts, but her friends cannot see them, and they're trying to solve this mystery that took place in this town. I say heavy in the sense that like it's not mentally heavy, it's not dark themes. It's actually very, very poppy, very, very colorful in a sense.
Sure.
But it was a lot of narrative thrown at you in this demo, and the publisher was really like, we really don't want to tutorialize you and tell you what you're doing, so just go into it blind, which was a little bit too overwhelming for me. But once June, the main character, gets sucked into this world of the undead, you also have a lot of combat scenarios. And these combat scenarios are really much areas where you're fighting off enemies for a little bit. You have a main sword as a standard attack, but what I find interesting is that there's also this sort of, the best way to describe it is a building mechanic. You collect energy from other enemies, and then you can mid-combat like throw up walls and throw up spikes or throw enemies at objects at your enemies to make sure they can get closer, so you can go around them and hit them with an attack. It feels a little bit off in a sense, but also it gives it really its own identity and style, I think.
It's very unique.
I was kind of puzzled at first where I was like, because they didn't tutorialize me, I was like, why is there an icon of a wall there? Let me just push the button. You pop up a big wall in front of an enemy that's walking at you and they can't go through it. And you can still hit them through the wall. So that helps, like giving you that little bit of boundary. But there's no dodge roll. There's no way to avoid enemies other than putting up those barriers. So I think that's a really fun way to get around like a sort of some of the tropes that the genre of third-person action games is.
I was going
to
say, it's Bayonetta by way of Fortnite.
I think I wouldn't put the building mechanic as like essential to this as Fortnite, but it did give the combat a really distinctive flavor, and I'm curious to see what other aspects they are experimenting with. I think it's good to mention that this one actually has a playable demo until September 2nd on PC. So if you really want to try it, then be sure to try it out. Again, no word on Switch because they first want to get the PC version and then work their way to ports later. But it looks really cool. And the writing was really, really charming as well. They use, I asked them about voiceovers because there was so much text going on. They said like, well, voiceover takes localization, which takes a lot of work, so we don't want to do that. So instead, they have these Animal Crossing-esque vibes, like characters talking these little, like, Simlish-esque dialogue, which works really well, actually. It gives it a little bit of charm to, like, dealing with themes of, like, death and people that have passed on.
Yeah. Well, when you're a team of, like, 5 people, I can understand not wanting to commit to multiple languages of voiceovers. Yeah, exactly. That makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. So it's also like, that's the one thing about like doing these demos with developers. They tell you the realities of like what it means to make these games. It's really fun.
Very honest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. while I was there, I also got to play Wilmot Works It Out. The follow-ups, I wouldn't call it the sequel, but the follow-up to Wilmot's Warehouse. It's still a puzzle game. It is very cute. You basically, as they pitched it, it's like Wilmot has one hobby when he gets home from the warehouse, and he's subscribed to this puzzle delivery service that just delivers puzzle pieces every time he's done with a puzzle, he gets new puzzle pieces. And you walk around the room, you put them together, you make these little framed pictures, and you put them up on your wall, and it's
very wholesome. It plays casually super well. So yeah, if you like puzzling, like jigsaw puzzling, this is totally up your alley.
I would subscribe to that subscription service.
I know, right?
A service that just sends me a puzzle piece every day, and I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, that should have been the business model for Street Pass, right?
Right. They send you a physical one in the mail.
Yeah, exactly.
Here is your physical puzzle piece.
Actually, I have to do puzzle swapping. Yeah. Oh man, that would have been fun.
Looks like that one also has a demo on Steam.
Yeah, exactly. Also, cool. I think available in the same time frame. If you have a Steam Deck, like this is one for that. I think like just having this, playing this, having something in the background. Like I know, if we can say, oh no, we like to be focused on game, but let's be fair, we all do this.
there are some games are multitasking games.
Yeah, exactly. And this one is perfect for those looking for it. Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot to do with Gamescom. I think Mighty Morphin Power Rangers Redux Rewind. I can be a bit short about this one because it's a beat 'em up, a retro style beat 'em up. If you've played one of those, like the Cowabunga collection that Digital Eclipse also did, you know what to expect with this one. What's kind of miffed about is actually I talked to Chris Kohler from Digital Eclipse afterward, and he was telling me that later stages in the game actually have these warping backgrounds and like unreal shooter segments and really start to play with what it means to be a retro game. And then that wasn't part of the demo. The demo was really much like walk left to right and go beat up these bosses.
The demo is showing the least interesting part of the game.
Yeah, and I was kind of miffed about that because he showed the trailer afterwards and was like, oh wait, that's the bits where you see the Megazords as well fighting. And
yeah,
I don't know, that looked really cool. So this is one to keep an eye out for. It's supposed to still release this year as well. So
yeah, and that one is coming to Switch.
Yeah, definitely.
100%.
Yeah. So and they are doing great work over there. And again, the guys at Digital Eclipse, I finally get to say I talked to them. They're great. Like, real fun.
That interview with, once again, not sure exactly when this episode is going up, so I don't know if it's on our YouTube yet, but that interview with Chris Kohler, too, is really good because you guys spend a little bit talking about Power Rangers and then just go into Digital Eclipse and game preservation and stuff, and it's a lot of fun to watch.
I mean, who was better to ask about their opinions on the Nintendo Museum than Digital Eclipse, right?
Right.
And that the trailer for that museum released last year. And Chris had some great, and I have to say, overlapping opinions with mine on that as well, which I really enjoyed. Good talking to them. And again, this game looks good. They were already saying, like, next year is going to be even more fun if you like the compilations bit. So fingers crossed that there's something cool in the pipeline.
Very curious to see what they do next.
Because
everything really they do is pretty much all great.
Yeah, exactly.
They did a remake of Wizardry this year that was really good. They could remake more of those and I'd be fine with it.
I am kind of hoping I don't have many like dream games from like other publishers that I think they should do. But I'd love to see their take with the Gold Master series on Myst. Or Riven, especially, because those are just mythical games in their legend. And they're ported everywhere, but you can do so much about their behind the scenes as well.
I know that the Video Game History Foundation has said they have a bunch of Cyan stuff, and I believe they share a building. So.
Yeah, they said so indeed. Yeah. So it's so funny that they...
It could happen.
It could happen. It's not out of the question.
I would love that. I adore the Myst series so much.
I played them fairly recently for the first time, and I was kind of like, oh, this feels old and outdated, but once you get into them, you really get into them, right? It's real fun.
Did you try their recent remake of Riven?
I have not yet. I heard it's good, though.
Did you play the original version at all?
No, I only played the original Myst, actually, and real Myst, I think, as well.
Riven is cool because they did enough to remake it that even if you have the original version kind of memorized like I do, they changed so much that it's like a whole new game. It's very, very good.
We can talk a little bit about, the interview is already up on the website and on the YouTube, but I talked to Takaya Imamura, who was just incredible. Like, the interview kind of shows most of the questions I had about his 30-year-long career. I actually asked you and some other folks about helping me input for the questions because I know how big of a Star Fox fan you are. And, like, I felt that was necessary. So we got some great answers about them. But what I really liked was that the first question I asked him was
fairly generic about Omega 6, his new project that he's working on, and that game is actually coming to Switch as well next year. I'm saying it correctly this time.
It's coming behind the scenes. We had to edit Willem's video when he got the date wrong.
Yeah. And that's what you get for crappy hotel Wi-Fi and editing everything on the laptop.
Right, right.
But he was great, and he was very quick in that first answer, where I was kind of like, oh no, this is going to be a very fast interview where he doesn't go into detail.
Yeah.
But after my second question, he just started going off, and like his translator was super patient with everything and translating so well. So I gave props to the people running that booth, because they did such an amazing job on picking that particular translator. Mm-hmm. Because it's funny, after I walked out of my interview, I actually met up with Donnie Fillerup, who is the owner of Console Variations. And he came in with this giant box of like N64 cartridges. So he had a boxed version of the F-Zero expansion pack for N64DD.
Yeah.
And he had it signed and everything. And he was just... and he came up really sheepishly, because he was asking me like, how nice is he? Is he willing to do this thing? I think you're good.
Yeah.
And Imamura comes out of the booth and he's just like, oh, this is so fun. He starts signing everything they hand to him. Like, he's so relaxed about it. And I'm very glad, like, he signed my copy of F-Zero GX. I got you a copy of Starwing as well. And it was so fun because it was unprompted, but he did a little drawing off the top of his head of both Slippy and on my F-Zero cartridge, he did a Captain Falcon design. And like, I was sitting there with someone else and we were both like stunned that he just did it on the top of his head without any hesitation. That's the mark of a good artist, right? He knows their characters. And I think I was scared at first, where he was like, I don't want to be like the guy who asks you all about your Nintendo highlights and like whatever you're
doing. You want to ask him about the thing he's actually there to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was so glad that he managed to like weave that back in a couple of times, because at times I was afraid, like, oh, we're talking just about Nintendo and Miyamoto and everything else. But he was like, no, this is actually my origin story at Nintendo weaves back into Omega 6 and my work as an artist and what I enjoy doing with art. So super proud of that interview, to be honest. I'm very happy I got this chance. And it was probably one of the highlights of Gamescom for me this year.
It's one of those interviews where it's like, who knows if we'll ever get to interview Imamura again. So it's an awesome thing to just have on the channel. And that interview went up and like the view counts on it are like fine, but not amazing. And I just sit here going like, do you people not know who this is? And then I'm like, oh, they probably don't.
No, like, no. And that's
like,
the thing.
Like for
right?
me, I'm like, it's Imamura. And I'm sure everybody else is like, who? And I'm like, it's a really big deal.
Yeah.
Watch the interview.
Yeah. I think you said this to me as well. I think those interviews will have long legs, right?
People will probably
like, when that day comes, people will realize, oh wait, that guy was actually at the forefront of a lot what they tried and did.
Yes. Well, and I will say, like, all of the we've got plenty of comments both like directly on the interview, and I know Go Nintendo shared it. So I've seen comments on it a few other places, like people seem to really enjoy it. And I think a lot of that is because like it's nice to have an interview where, yes, we're still going to talk about the Nintendo stuff, but we're also going to let him talk about his current thing, because it does bother me when I see all those interviews with him ostensibly about Omega 6 where they're just like, so F-Zero, and it's like, man, let him talk about his game.
I was actually really happy, because I think when I arrived at Cologne on Tuesday or Wednesday that evening, the IGN interview with him went live, and they really went hard on like the original Nintendo questions
stuff
and everything.
Yeah.
And I thought that's great, because I don't need to ask them, right? We got that out there. He knows what he did, right?
Yeah.
So I kind of used it as a springboard to be like, okay, I want to be the real niche questions, and we need to know which ending to Star Fox Command is canon, which we do know. Definitely.
Yes.
It's official. He says it's only his opinion. No, we know better.
It's only his opinion, but he was the lore keeper for Star Fox and F-Zero. So
he drew all those endings. We know what he liked best.
Yeah. He decides.
Yeah. Yeah. Real good. I have one more thing that I really want to talk about, and that's one that's coming up later on the website. So I don't know how well this is going to work out. But one thing I was really excited about is actually, so I'm one of those weirdos that mods their own Game Boys. So this is actually one of my Game Boy Colors that has an
I need to show it. Like, it has an AMOLED screen, so every pixel that's darkened is actually turned off.
Yeah.
Right? I love modern Game Boys. I think the Game Boy is just a great system. So I was really excited to talk to the guys who work for Mod Retro, who are releasing the Chromatic. So the Chromatic is a new handheld Game Boy device that is designed to be like the perfect iteration of the Game Boy. And that's a fair claim. Like, ever since, for those of you who know, emulation via FPGA cores went kind of mainstream with the Analog Pocket. Like, people are very much more able to create their own Game Boy motherboards and kind of springboard off of that. There have been a lot of companies that are like, oh, we're making a Game Boy and whatever. And these guys were also, I was kind of hesitant. One thing, because the founder of the company is Palmer Luckey. Think of him what you will, please. He will not deny what he did. We know what he did. but that's kind of complicated. But I really wanted to focus on just this Game Boy because I saw the previews, or at least the photos they shared online. I was like, okay, this might be interesting. And I got to sit down with the creative team behind it. I've also been in touch with the engineer who's been working on the screen for the last couple of months and years that they've developed this device. I've held it in my hand. I don't have a unit here, but I tried it over there. This thing is a real deal.
Should have stolen it.
Well,
gotta be fast.
I'm working on it. Don't worry.
You just go, it's in the name of game preservation, and just run off with it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's very funny. But I held it. This is the real deal. This is such an amazing iteration of the Game Boy. It only does Game Boy and Game Boy Color. So it doesn't do the Analog Pocket where you have all these modules and you can do GBA as well and, you know, software install things. They are really dedicated to just making that great, perfect Game Boy Color. And what's interesting, it also uses AA batteries. At first, when I heard that, I was like, oh no, what are you doing to yourself? But they had two reasons, which I found really interesting. One is it helps with the weight. So if you actually try this original Game Boy, right, the batteries add a little bit of weight and squishiness to the buttons. They actually prefer add some resistance to pushing a button in because of the battery at the back of it. That feel is unbelievably well balanced on a shell that is made of magnesium alloy. So it's like a steel frame that you're holding, but because of the batteries, it adds a little bit of weight. It fits perfectly in the hand. The other reason they actually said is, much like an old Game Boy, if you pop in AA batteries, it just works. There's no leaking of lithium batteries, and that is a real risk with e-waste, but also like in the long term, you kind of don't want your perfect, like, I think this goes for like $185, $200 handheld. You don't want that to be ruined by a battery going bust. And this really prevents that as well. So can you call it a marketing tool? Maybe, but I do feel like that aspect of it is kind of like really going back to like what the physical components of the Game Boy made interesting. And feeling it over there, having it in hand. And I also compared the screens of my own Game Boys with them. I made a lot of B-roll footage. I'm going to compare them all and compile it all into a giant elaborate preview. That screen is really good. Like, it has, it renders every individual pixel on screen in the perfect aspect ratio. Like, the Analog Pocket is good. I think this might actually be better because it's just much more primary focused on what it wants to do. That's really impressive, honestly, playing it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And so I was about to walk out and then they were like, well, we got you something. And that's the real Goulding. So they gave me the entire library for the Chromatic in demo form. So what they're doing is actually releasing new games for the Chromatic that work on your original Game Boy. What's interesting, for a couple of them, they are working with the original developers. So I mentioned Two Tribes earlier, and Tokitori has a new version coming out. So it's very accessible. And
interesting.
Actually, if I put it here in my original Game Boy, it boots up.
Would have been really funny if it didn't boot.
Yeah, they only added in their own original logo. But you get Tokitori as it was originally designed and improved, actually. So the developers went back, and this is a new version of Tokitori, actually. It's not just the original game.
That's really cool.
It is packed in with a Tetris version. There's an RPG as well that's called Dragonim, which is very much like a Zelda-like RPG and very elaborate and extensive. And what they're doing is they kind of working closely with the GB dev community, so people that are making very good Game Boy
games for Game Boy hardware. They're trying to get them to license to Chromatic and also bring those out as physical cartridges that you can use on your original Game Boy as well as this new one. So
yeah,
I'm still getting my teeth into these games. They're very fun. But it's really a company that is trying to go the extra mile. And while I was very skeptical, I'm kind of biting into drinking the Kool-Aid, so to speak. So I'm still hoping to finally get my hands on the final unit because this was still a prototype. There were some quirks they're still working out. It's one if you are into Game Boys and original handhelds, like this is one to keep an eye out for, I think. It should be available at GameStop, even in the US. So you're lucky again.
Assuming GameStop is still around by the time it comes
out. That's the real question, right? Well, it's probably better than my like 500 euro import fee for taxes.
right. Did you want to cover Retrobit at all?
I mentioned them quickly. So I had an appointment with both Apido, how you want to call them. We can talk about that for an hour, I guess.
8BitDO.
8BitDO. They make those good controllers that you like.
Yeah.
They are still going to be doing that for the foreseeable future. What is really interesting, not just on the Nintendo front, but they made these new keyboards and buttons that are compatible with keyboards, like really good. Like clicky keyboards. I got my hands on those. Play really well. Good, look nice. Actually, what they have is now they have 4 action buttons that you can hook up to this computer. So you can actually make programmable buttons. So if you really like that retro style, that works great. They're also working with Xbox for accessibility controllers add-ons. New joysticks, new things that can all be added to the accessibility controllers. And what they told me is that Microsoft has been super open about the platform. So they're really much like, these are the design specs, go nuts with them, make whatever you want. It's all fine to be the accessibility controller. So I hope Nintendo or PlayStation take notes for this, because I think it's just great if people get to play more games via those accessibility controllers.
I know PlayStation is doing some sort of accessibility thing. Yeah, I don't know if it's as open source as the Xbox stuff is.
Right, but they released that round pad thing, I think, with buttons on the side. And I think it probably works fine, too. But the way Microsoft has kind of embraced it is commendable, to say the least.
Yeah. Agreed.
And then companies like 8BitDO jumping on that, is, I think that's also good because they know how to make controllers. What they also showed was their new GameCube style controller. So they have one that's coming out that's like purple, has the original GameCube buttons as well, 2 sticks. And you can connect them wirelessly via both the original GameCube and modern systems with their dongles. Real fun if you are the diehard person that has to play Smash with the GameCube controller, this is the way to go. And then there was also the guys from Retrobit. So Retrobit are twofold. On one hand, they make also these Japanese design-like controllers. So they made the Hori pad for the N64. They re-released that and redesigned it. I think you might be very into this, but it's a very cool form factor and translucent shell as well. These also come with the dongles to plug into your original N64 too. So that was really cool. And what they are especially known for or busy working on is re-licensing and translating Japanese cult classic games. A lot of games that were only available in Japan and never have been localized or re-released or retranslated, they are looking into who the rights holders are and communicating with them to make new physical releases for these games. Now, they were still mainly focused on like actually only doing the physical releases of these. So you can get original, I think they did games for the NES, for Game Boy, for Mega Drive, I think for PC Engine as well, but might be wrong on that. Anyway, they're really focusing on like getting the original art assets and also looking through the game's original code to see what they can change or improve if needed. But usually they leave the games alone wherever possible. And they've been really hard at work to like bring that program up to snuff for really retro collectors. So if you love Japanese obscure games that never gotten a shot outside of the Japanese area, this might be something you might be interested in. And they're releasing a whole range of new products and releases. One that was really interesting that they were working on was actually for the Dreamcast. They are redesigning a new controller that also works wirelessly and also has plays for the VMU as well. So
nice.
That would be really cool as a design point.
I have seen some third-party Dreamcast controllers that don't have a VMU slot, which is a fascinating choice.
I know, right?
Kind of worthless.
Yeah, the most recognizable bit about the controller you want to kind of include it, I presume.
But I would like to be able to save my game, please.
Yeah, exactly right. It's crazy.
Anything we missed?
I think that's, yeah, most of what I did. I think yeah, there was just so much to do this year, and again, back-to-back meetings is really really intense. So kind of keeping track of everything you played and then talking to folks and then also realizing what you did. Like, I have this whole I think this is from another game, like a whole stack of stickers and other business cards, random for people that I got, swag and everything. Yeah, random swag as well. I think, like, my the game library is very cool swag, but I also managed to get some really nice pins as well again this year, which I really liked collecting. The swag is always fun. good times at Gamescom, I'd say.
Great. Well, as we've said several times over the course of this, there is a bunch of interviews and previews both on NintendoWorldReport.com and our YouTube channel, Nintendo World Report TV. Just there's a metric butt ton of it. I have seen Willem's schedule for stuff coming out the week that we're recording this, and it's just a constant feed of stuff. And I've watched a bunch of it, and it's very good. Keep an eye out for that stuff, unless it's already out by the time this podcast comes out, in which case, go back and watch it.
Watch it again. Come on, we need to Imamura. Just keep Everyone watching needs it. To know who Imamura is. Come on, you can do
the
this.
Algorithm.
Yes.
All right. Well, Willem, thank you very much for joining me. I'm glad we could finally find a time where we could actually do this at the same time in person.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to put the world in Nintendo World Report.